Hello. Welcome to recording number 10 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Already more than 3 years have passed since the end of the Beggar Thieves Guild War. And I'm going to start here on page 70, the last paragraph. Making good on their supposed reason for coming to the Clerkburg promised to be more difficult than finding quarters had been. When they first took up residence in the academic area, the college term was over, and most students were elsewhere for several weeks until the new one began. But if Gord and San were to be seen as students, they had to be students. The boys had to find someone to accept them as pupils. From his lessons in Theobald's Hall, Gord had developed fair proficiency with the pen, and he could read common speech as well as the basics of the modern Aridian and Sul languages. He could read maps, building plans, and some small amount of the writings used in spells. He could skillfully use the silent speech of the beggars, and understood much of the patois of both the Rene and the Thieves' Cant. San had about half this much skill, all told, and both initially had felt rather confident at their prospects for entering some college. They hit upon the idea of becoming acquainted with an old sage by the name of Prosper, who dwelt nearby. The fellow grew herbs and puttered in his workshop when not reading. Since Calvert had once introduced them, the boys felt free to approach the old man. Their vast ignorance in all subjects was quickly made obvious to them, as the ancient scholar deluged them with what he claimed were simple questions, and neither lad could answer 1 in 20. Break. All right. Coming to Clerkburg has been more than just the idea of laying low. But in part of the general theme of the idea that Gord is always conscious of disguise and remaining hidden, that he and San are both more than just hiding in Clerkburg. They're going to actually be students if they're going to pretend to be students. Now, we have here an introduction to a few things. This is the first mention of three languages, the common speech, the Aridian and Sul languages, and both referred to as modern Aridian and Sul languages. So we can see that here that Gygax is thinking that even the older Aridian and perhaps the older Sul, that there's both versions that have changed over the years. And more than likely, since there's such a melding of Aridian, Sul, Flan within the Flaness, that each of these language probably has regional dialects. And depending on the way the population is, it's probably got additions of all these other languages, which is common, particularly what common speech and is kind of more of a trader's tongue. Now, we also have the mention that the beggars' silent speech, but I believe that the beggars also had a language of their own. There is a language of the Rene, and then the thieves' cant. Now, there had also been previous mentions of a merchant's cant, that the merchants had a secret language as well as the thieves. Now, we look back at what Gord learned in a very short time in Theobald's Hall. Was he learned reading, writing these various languages. You know, he even learned, besides reading maps and building plans, which you could see for a thief would be useful, but he even learned some of the writings used in spells. And that kind of sets an idea in the campaign that the basic use of spellcraft is something that you know, anybody can get an idea of what the spell names are, potion names, a general idea of what the magic users are using without being able to actually cast spells themselves. Calvert is the innkeeper where they're staying at the Acorns. And now we're introduced to Prosper, who is a sage and a teacher. And there, Gord is now being exposed, Gord and Sand, to the larger world where they are all these questions that are going to come up here that neither Sam nor Gord have any idea about. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 71, paragraph 3. What are the 9 known dimensions of the multiverse? The good doctor demanded. Sam managed the 3 obvious ones, length, breadth, height. Astrality and etherality, Gord added proudly. He was stuck after that. Time, probability, extraconceivability, and non-conceivability. Conceivability. Dr. Prosper finished, and both boys squirmed. From whence came the common tongue? When was the Empire of the Aerity overthrown? What is leverage? How can you explain technology? Ford took a shot at that one. It is a myth of the ignorant used to fool gullible folk and frighten children. Nonsense, the elderly scholar retorted. It is the counterpart of magic within the dimension of probability, and works in inverse proportion to it. Then he resumed firing off questions. What was the invoked devastation, and when did it occur? Of what use is basilisk blood in alchemy? Enumerate the inner planes. There are 12. Name them. Relate the major deities of Earth to the minor ones and explain how they relate to the forces of the lower planes. What is the largest tree known? Bronewood Sand shot back with relief. Good, said Prosper. What vegetation and creatures are typically found in association with Ronewoods? There was no reply forthcoming, so the sage continued his barrage. What are the characteristic differences between the races of men? Do they make us into different species, or merely indicate variations? Likewise, explain the racial differences of demi-humankind and relate them to humans. This is most unfair, Dr. Prosper. You're a renowned sage, said Gorge, a twinge of desperation in his tone. Come, come, lads, the white-bearded chap said, shaking his head. What authority have you that I am renowned? No, no, quite the contrary. I am but a minor scholar now put out to pasture, seen as being too old to have anything worth teaching to today's students. The old man paused and fixed first Sam, then Gord with his stern gaze. That is not to say you both aren't abominably ignorant, though it is surprising that you know your letter so well. Break. My, this is, you know, quite a bit in these question and that are going in the answers from Gord and Sam.
And Greyhawk 101.
It is, and I would wish that there had been a kind of continual questioning and answering. This would have provided quite a bit of background information, and instead, it's mostly within the campaign, you know, various unanswered questions. I think that the common tongue is explained in the folio and the box 83 box set, but very, very interesting. And also seeing the mix of the scholarly and the touch of what would kind of be the medieval touch to such scholarly questions. The question about technology is, I think, very very amusing, but it does show that that it is something known and looked down upon by Gord and perhaps the common person that the idea of a little touch there that instead of magic, it is technology that is looked down upon. Do we get a lot of things. We're introduced to the invoked devastation, the empire of the Erdi. We have that there are 12 inner planes, but no exact mention of what they are except perhaps the lower planes. It'd be interesting to hear the answer to the relation of the major deities to the minor ones and the forces of the lower planes. The Roanwood, I'm assuming, is a particularly Greyhawk species of tree. But then it would be nice to have all these various things, the ecologies of the differences mentioned in Greyhawk demihumans and between the races of men. Finally, we have that it is how well that Gord and San have learned their letters in the Thieves Guild, in the Beggars Union, I'm afraid, the Beggars Union, but are still very ignorant of what this scholar thinks is the wider world's knowledge right here, the academic's knowledge. All right, I'm going to restart. We are on page 72, and this should be paragraph 9. Boys looked at each other, but before either could think of any reply, the old man concluded the interview. "I'd have mistaken you both for a pair of cleaned-up urchins from Old Town Way, but where would you find funds to be here? And how could you be staying in that loft you're furnishing at the Acorns? Then I suppose that you are a pair of precocious thieves, what with the funds you have and the sort of weapons you tote about. But then, why would thieves be wishing to become educated? Therefore, I must conclude that you're a pair of bright lads from the back country, sadly in need of edification and instructions. Lessons begin next Wednesday, and you'll get only God's Day free from them each week. Each next Waters Day.
Easy mistake.
Yeah, that is, if you could afford the tuition." Again, Gord and Sam looked at each other in blank surprise. "Oh, come now, can you? It's the standard charge, 6Z per week. Each, you know, and you must bring enough lunch to feed your teacher as well as yourselves." Break. All right. Well, I mean, again, here also is the idea that the people in authority and skill and knowledge, they all seem to be able to look below the surface. And here, Prosper is able to touch on that they do seem to be either urchins or thieves, and that it's unlikely that either would be seeking education. So perhaps generally unaware of the warfare that had been going on between them, but at the same time, Prosper being experienced enough to be able to pick them out as who they really are behind the assumed identities that they're using. We're introduced to some of the names of the weekdays, Water Day and God's Day. And finally, if you see that for how inexpensive things are. Now, he is only talking about the charge is 6 bronze Zs per week. Now, that is, it's less than coppers, but it is still, fairly reasonable, fairly expensive for the poor to be able to afford that 6 Zs per week for, the start of this individual education. But Prosper is working with them, going to be working with them 6 days a week. So that's only going to be one of the one Z each per day.
And they have to feed him too, though.
And they have to feed him. I thought that was a very amusing touch. Yeah.
He's quite a character.
Yeah. But yeah, if you think that Prosper is, you know, it doesn't say what other money he's bringing in, but it seems like this is a pretty much a completely full-time work for him, and all he's going to be making are two Z's a day, you know. And so that, you know, the Z is below the copper. So imagine, you know, this Greyhawk economy at this point is, you know, these low value coins, as a gold economy, you know, gold is such a powerful and valuable item in this Greyhawk that Gygax is showing us. And I think in that case, it really would make things much more interesting than the way that, you know, the very limited kind of game economy that they show. I think it'd be much more interesting to have it where gold was rare, you know, and valuable, and that even in maybe treasure troves, you didn't come across it, and certain items were incredibly expensive. You know, I would think that armor would be, it's a very labor-intensive, you know, to come up with armor. And a lot of armor was crafted toward the individual. You know, it wasn't coming off the rack. So, you know, I would say that it would be very interesting to run your campaign with this kind of scarcity of gold. And where you're going out and, you know, at low levels, you're earning coppers instead of gold pieces. All right. I am going to restart, and it is page 73, first paragraph. Studies were hard under the crotchety Dr. Prosper. He was a mine of information. Although it was surely known to Calvert that his tenants attended no regular school, but were instead tutored by his neighbor, the good man never made mention of it. Drill continued for the whole time of the university sessions. The sage worked both boys hard, and they found that they had to do more than pay tuition to him and bring extra food. There were always things to buy. Bill pens, parchment, blank scrolls, and books, and occasionally even a scribe text of some sort, although Prosper would usually allow the boys to utilize his personal library under his keen-eyed surveillance. Break. All right, well, this, you know, this right here, this is an interesting view on this structure of how the things are in the academic section here of the city of Greyhawk, that it and also about where they are in their technology, in that quill pens, parchments, blank scrolls, and books. Now, by the time that they have reached it, where they have books and a library of scrolls and scribe texts, then we're looking at, you know, a pretty much the medieval idea of you know, where they are in the world of books and paper, and that is such, you know, it's such an important thing. I think like I've seen some campaigns where they have newspapers, but I think that we're looking at Greyhawk as seen as something that is not up to that level of technology. I don't think we're going to see printing presses and mass-produced books. I think if they have books, everything is handwritten or magically written. So they're going to have books, parchment scrolls, and you know, it shows the kind of fantasy medieval atmosphere and that the setting is really kind of being tied down to. And it's always what I felt was that, you know, the Greyhawk campaign is looking more at that medieval fantasy than like even a Renaissance fantasy or even a fantasy that also has technology or uses magic technology. I think the essence of Greyhawk is that there is magic, and it is not an unknown. It is there, but at this, and it is commonly accepted the way that Gord thinks of technology as something that's a myth, and magic as what is the mundane. But at the same time, it's not commonplace. And I don't think that the whole Greyhawk campaign, it might have powerful magic, but I don't think it's something that is run into commonly. But it is known. You know, it is known. It's kind of like the way that somebody here in our world would own a private jet, but it's not something that the average individual or even like the lower rich individual who might not be able to afford it. I would think that magical devices are well beyond the average person in this campaign that Gygax is expressing right here.
Have we seen more than one example yet? I know we had that lantern. We had that lantern in the.
Yeah, I know. Now, it was said that Theobald had even hired magic users, but I don't think there's been a single spell cast.
Right.
Or any, like Theobald never seemed, besides that lantern they talked about that the mercenaries had, I don't think there's been a single example that I can remember of any clerical or, magic user magic that has been shown so far.
It mentioned the Rene had magic, but they didn't show it.
Oh, the Rene women, mm-hmm. That had a kind of magic and combined, because they were both, they could divination, they acted as witches, and they also acted as a kind of priestess. So the Rene women kind of combine a kind of magic user clerical magic use, but with no examples given of what that meant.
Yeah, so it's very low magic so far.
Very. I mean, even that thief, Ladovov, he was supposedly very high up in the guild, yet you don't know. Nothing was mentioned. Either Gord was just unaware. Now, you know, he did get several weapons, like, from Ladovov, and it could be that those weapons might have been enchanted and Gord didn't know it. But nothing has been mentioned about magic weapons, magic armor, rings. There's nothing that's come to Gord's attention that is clearly magical.
We can only guess what was in Theobald's box.
That's right. And, you know, it might have contained more than coin. But magic is obviously known. At the same time, it's not commonplace. The Beggars Union, even the head of it, is obviously not somebody, and even with money and skill, that where he did not have access to anything super powerful. You know, but back in these days, even the most powerful magicians in the campaign were nothing like things became later, you know, pushing up what level they were supposed to be and how much power they were supposed to be. We have mention of things like the lower planes and, areas beyond even the reality that they're living in right now. But at the same time, we're not really given to much. We have mention of a basilisk, because how is a basilisk's blood is used? But again, Gord mentioned early on about ogres and trolls, and but what we don't have is we haven't really been inundated with many demi-human races, the tall fellows, gnomes. There was a dying gnome in the workhouse, but for the most part, we're really not exposed. This is a very seemingly very human-centered campaign. And very, very magic being very uncommon. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 73, paragraph 2. Although studies, homework, and occasional carousing took most of their time, Both boys had promised themselves that they would not allow their more nefarious talents to grow rusty and forgotten. Things had quieted sufficiently so that they felt comfortable outside the district. On their one day of the week free from lessons, Gordon San would walk with the stream of students drifting towards the strip. There, and in the fringes of the river quarter and low quarter as well, they worked at picking pockets, slitting purses, pilfering small items, and even the planning of mock burglaries, robberies, and executions. By these activities, they didn't profit much, but enough, and neither was detected. One day, San brought two old locks back to the loft. He picked them up at a locksmith for a small price, for both were old and in need of work. It became a game for them, first to repair such old locks, then to pick them open. Soon the place was littered with heaps of repaired and oiled locks of all sizes and descriptions that the two had mastered. Gord made a fair profit by peddling them back to the same locksmiths who had originally got rid of them. San was pleased, talked Gord out of the money they'd made, and went out to find the best locks that their money could buy. In this fashion, studying, practicing, carousing, and lockpicking, the boys passed nearly a year, and generally had a good time in doing so. Break. All right, now, I'm going to jump to the last concept that another year has passed. Now, it could be, I'm thinking this is either a year in furtherance of the 3 years that they said had passed, or a description of 1 year within that 3 years. So this is either Gord and San, Gord turning from, like, say, 16 to 17, and San going from 13 to 14, and what happened after. But it could also be that this is what was occurring during that 3 years. Because that is a big
accounting of the time that passed.
Yeah, it's not really defined. It's just, I find it very hard to see that as detailed as the story's been, it's a little odd to jump forward 3 years without any explanation of what was happening during that time. So I'm thinking that maybe what we're looking at here, the, you know, meeting Prosper and learning all the, getting the education, and now keeping up the practice of their thievery and such, that this may have been occurring within those 3 years. But again, it might as easily be that this is now another year having passed, and that, you know, them being pushed further along. It's interesting to see what things that they are keeping up with themselves, that they're interested, Gordon Sam, in going back to the strip in the river quarter where the thieves are, you know, very present. So it is hard to see. Maybe that 3 years has passed, because it seems that, you know, they're willing to go back into what is the heart of the Thieves Guild operations in the river quarter and the strip. Now, it was interesting to learn how they pick up the locksmithing for themselves, obviously getting some training in that from Theobald and the Beggars Union. I find it very interesting. One of the things, planning mock burglaries, robberies, and executions. Now, that executions, I mean, are they learning, like, assassin abilities, or is that just mean execution of operations? Say, like, that operation where Violet went out as a courtesan and Gord went with her as her serving boy. We really never got too much of an idea of what, unless it was just that robbery that Violet was planning, whether that was the operation being planned. And when they say executions, I just don't think they're learning to be assassins.
It connotes that, though.
What's that?
It sounds like that.
It does. There is this idea that maybe part of their training was also in assassination. But it could be, it makes, the way it's phrased, that makes more sense than execution of operations, where you think that would be you know, something that would come out more, where they would talk about mock burglaries, robberies, and, you know, maybe con execution of cons that they were putting on and swindles. But it does sound like they're learning, keeping the idea of, and they had been. I mean, they had learned that in a sense during the Beggar Thieves Guild War. That's one of the things they were doing with the mercenaries, was going out and killing people.
Yeah, and, both killed.
Yeah. And so maybe that's what they mean, that they were keeping up. And I just wonder, did Gygax have that more in mind of what a thief would do, to also learn some specialized combat, more than the backstab, but also tricky things that could be like assassins, which would generally make them more useful as an adventurer than just the guy who, you know, searched for traps and picked locks. If they also knew how to fight, and perhaps not in the direct way that a swordsman or would learn, but that they would learn how to do it in, you know, assassination means. Perhaps there was always the idea of the use of poisons and, you know, various things that could be used to kill, and not in direct, like, sword-to-sword learning.
Right. We never usually used poison. Just evil characters would typically use poison in our campaigns.
Yeah, and there was the assassin class, you know, in advanced. It was not considered to be part. It was a subclass of thief, though.
Right.
You know, the assassin wasn't a subclass of fighter. It was a subclass of thief. So, and the kind of instruction they were getting was not a typical thieves instructions. So, who knows what the plans had been and what kind of education they were actually getting, becoming the beggar thieves. But so it is entirely possible that they learned to be beggar thief assassins. All right, I thought it was interesting. The idea, there's another little technological idea here about the locks. They seem to be very common. In fact, there is a locksmith, not just the blacksmith, but a locksmith, who would specialize in opening and creating the various locks and repairing like they were doing. But obviously not willing to do it for themselves, with Gordon Sand making a profit repairing broken locks.
Right. And then Sand getting the money back from Gord.
Yeah. And that just to buy better locks.
Yeah. Funds their education.
Yeah. And so far, it seems like it was mentioned previously that they had been maintaining enough of an income through their thievery that they had not needed to touch their gold and their platinum and what they'd gotten from Theobald, or even the little nest egg they had built up for themselves, which was kind of enough money. Each had had about 1,000 Z's, which is about a gold piece. And what they had been able to set aside each was about a gold piece. But depending on the copper to gold piece value. I mean, here we have Prosper taking in 2 Z's a day. And, that is his, maybe his sole income, and enough, and in a meal, and enough to go on with at that earn. And that is a reasonable payment for a sage. And we know that 1,000 Z's is only one gold piece. One gold piece would pay for, you know, per person, per 3 years worth of education. So it really tells you that, gold is immensely valuable, from a commoner's point of view. Although from the rich, there could be this level of magic and crafted material that is extraordinarily expensive, and that would keep it out of any form of having that kind of armor or weaponry or magical items that would be available to the average person. You know, like not see anything like that in a village, in small towns, maybe only a few pieces of good armor or good weaponry or, you know, especially magical items.
Well, that would be a good reason for why people went adventuring, because yes, they don't see it in town. They need to go get it.
And I think what it also talks about is that there, my idea, and the kind of being built up from this too, is that there is a much more mundane world, and then what is out there with the monsters and the treasures and the ruins, that is something that is exceptional. And all the people like Gord and San are exceptional. And, you know, very, like here you have people who are like the top athletes or the Olympic, you know, quality people. And then you have the average people who are the craftsmen and the sages, and that there is maybe two really big levels, social distinctions here between the average and the poor, because there doesn't seem to be as much change from the poorest of the slum quarter people and the people like Prosper, who is he's making a lot more than the iron drabs that are found in the slum quarter, but he's not making anywhere near what, like, the gold or the platinum, you know, that platinum economy, the gold economy. The people who are spending lots of that, they're making a tremendous amount more, you know, than somebody like Prosper, who is a respected, even a minorly respected sage and teacher. So I, you know, really, and the cost of staying in that loft is, you know, it is so small, it's in coppers per month, that I don't think that, we haven't been told, but I don't think the distinction between coppers and gold is minor. I think there's a big difference between having a copper piece and a gold coin. A copper common and a gold orb. I just think that there's a big difference, and that would mean there's a very big difference in, the levels of the rich and the commoner. Not as much as between the poor and the commoner. All right, I'm going to restart here. We are on page 73, the last paragraph. At the end of the instructional term came news from Dr. Prosper. Informed the boys that teaching them had grown tiresome to him. They were slow students, always asking dumb questions, and generally trying the patience of a weary old scholar. No, he didn't deserve such punishment in his declining years. Instead, he had talked to some old associates at Gray College, and the troublesome fellows would be their charges next term. This was incredible news. Gray College wasn't the most fashionable institution, but it was the oldest and was renowned for its professors. Now they were true students. During the 9-week, the hiatus in summer that included Wheel Sun Month, Rich Fest Week, and Reaping Month, the two celebrated continually. They also spent a lot of time at their work, so to speak. One of the first things they managed was a new wheelbarrow for Prosper, which they filled with gardening tools, a keg of Rhenish schnapps, and wheels of cheese and huge sausages, and an assortment of old ale to top the load off. The doctor never mentioned it, but Gord knew he was pleased. Before their schooling began again, Gord also located an arms instructor willing to accept two young pupils who wished to learn the use of sword and dagger. For while they had often practiced the non-violent crafts of thievery, they were both in need of bettering themselves at weapon play. Break. All right. I like the mention of Gray College, and as being maybe no longer the most fashionable, but definitely the oldest of the Greyhawk City colleges. We're given a few more, bits with Greyhawkery during the 9-week for students. Wheel Sun, Rich Fast Reaping. So we're given a little more of the gray campaign dating system that's used. They talk about the Rentisch Schnapps, and that doesn't summon up something immediately for me about what that would be. You know, it's a drink, it's an alcoholic drink, Schnapps, but I'm trying to think of Rentisch, where that would be or what that would be linked to. Now we also see that the huge, you know, a rather large amount of food and ale, and, you know, like the wine and gardening tools. So the Gourd recognizes that what Prosper is saying, by calling them dumb, poor students is really, it's really not what it's simply a way, to keep their humility in, I think. And at the same time, shows how much he thought of them to introduce them to Gray College. And that is, you know, definitely, you know, it's what Gourd had at least wanted, and perhaps seeing where they were really students now, accepted at a university at Gray College, instead of just being more like rich dilettantes paying for instruction, that they had improved themselves. And finally, as we were commenting, you know, Gourd and San are both now, they're going to have an arms instructor. So they're getting some kind of fighter training that they did not get, even from the training they got as beggar thieves. They obviously had gotten some of that. They definitely learned the backstab. And both Gourd, and it is mentioned that Gourd and San both, you know, they did know some combat abilities, but here it's mostly their abilities are non-violent crafts of thievery. So again, it's that execution that we talked about, that's a very, you know, it seems a little out of place or incomplete, and I'd really wished we had learned a little more context for what Gygax meant by that. All right, I'm going to continue here. It is page 74, paragraph 3. College was not all that they had hoped. It wasn't just that the students' studies were hard. Their classmates were snobbish, and the dons were worse. Gourd managed better than San, for he was older. By this time, the younger boy had grown taller and larger than Gourd. When their first year of instruction at Gray College ended, San informed his friend that he had had enough of bookish pursuits. There was no arguing with him, and that week he went off to apply to the Thieves Guild as a cut purse. Even though they both knew his skills were a notch or two greater than that, San had met a pretty young lass in the course of one of the boys' forays on the strip. They were soon seeing one another regularly, and she had told him that her father was a ranking member of the guild, so San had confessed his own skills. After that, nothing would do but for him to talk with her father, and the result was foregone thereafter. Gourd and San had a farewell party, and then the latter young men left their loft at the Acorns, promising to return often. He had come a few times at first, but the visits grew less frequent and shorter too, and then stopped altogether around Needfest break during Gourd's next academic term. Gourd maintained the big apartment alone, using the empty area as an exercise and practice space. Break. Well, as we started with this recording, 3 years had passed, and I wasn't quite sure then that the time passing wasn't within that period, but it really seems to me at this point that it was, and that we're now moving years ahead at a time. So if we look at that first 3 years that had passed, and then another under the study of Prosper, and now another as students at Gray College, we have now pushed Gourd up to about 18 or older, and even San is probably 15 or 16. which in the city here seems to be easily enough to be considered an adult. San Gord is a small individual, and San has already at that age grown larger and bigger than Gord, so he's taller and bigger. But here we have a little bit about the structure of the college, which seems less medieval and more kind of classical, English, what do they call that? Public school or,
education, or I'm not sure.
With the idea of dons and the snobbish students.
Right.
It seems like it's kind of patterned off of, classical 17th, 18th century, even 19th century English colleges structure. And that is not out of keeping with the idea that this is not medieval, it's fantasy medieval, and that not everything is patterned exactly off of, the real world here. And that what we're seeing is this amalgamation. I think Gygax was very much into the historical, I also think that a lot of his influences were movies and popular fiction. So I think that one of the things that makes Greyhawk Campaign so likable is that I think its basics aren't anything dry, but are exciting. So I think that if Gygax looked at something historical, he looked at what excited or interested him in history. And then I think when he thought about adventures, he looked at fantasy novels, he looked at movies, and maybe the old pulps and stuff. And so I think that the Greyhawk Campaign is based on what was most exciting to Gygax, even if it did not follow, a historical continuity. And in a sense, it really shouldn't. The fantasy campaign, it shouldn't just be a mirror of historical, because the influences are radically different. The way the world is set up, the powers that exist, they are radically different than anything in earthly history, our real world history.
Yeah, for sure. Even the things that they study would be completely different.
Oh, yes. And that's what I found particularly amusing about Prosper's questions is that, we have our own vernacular in various studies. And it can be, I remember taking philosophy courses in college and how they seemed to use like seven terms over and over again. And it really didn't matter what you said as long as you use those terms and rearrange them every so often. And they were, equally unintelligible and without context. And I think that it's very interesting seeing here that list of questions is very revealing on a little, even though I would love to have heard Gygax's views of these details. It's very inspirational just to have these little tidbits, but it also gives you an idea of how the world works. And I think we step into the academia and perhaps the way that magic has worked, and we're now stepping out of what is just historically medieval into a much different world. And some of it based on our developing modern world of the last few centuries, but also on this idea that the way that magic and knowledge is in the Greyhawk setting, it has its own little advancement that what you would find. And in our world, most people who were considered magicians in the past were, are modernly, they're not considered to have wielded any real magic or power, just mostly con men. But in this world, like somebody like Rasputin would be considered to be a powerful cleric, or Dr. D, who's a medieval, magician, and these other people in the past who were the court magicians and stuff, and not getting back to like Merlin or anything in more mythological or story, but the ones who are actual historical figures, they wouldn't be looked down upon. They would be individuals of actual power. And that is one of the big things to capture in the setting, is that the people who were these magic users were people of great power and respect because of that power and fear and how they were valued one way or the other. All right. We now have San and Gord break up. I mean, it is interesting to me that San is able to, you know, after that beggar thief war, that now San has gone from a 10-year-old during that time period to probably a 15 or 16-year-old, and right. with much different physical growth. But it is interesting to me that he is immediately, you know, he is not called toward the education that Gord is interested in, but immediately goes and starts involving himself in the Thieves Guild. Now, there is the business of meeting the girl whose father is high ranking in the guild. That is, of course, an opening for him to get into the Thieves Guild. But that San is probably more of a thief at heart than the Gord is something a little bit more. You know, Gord is learning, you know, straight up fighting. He's getting an academic education. He's good at all these various things, and that he is either in game terms of a different class or a multi-class. And I believe that Gygax's plan was for Gord to represent a separate character class, like a subheading under fighter or subheading under thief. I'm going to restart. This is page 75, paragraph 2. Now his second year as a college student had come to an end, and Gord was undecided and restless. After all, how much did he need to know about politics, philosophy, natural and supernatural arts, pantheology, and the like? Sure, it was interesting to learn ancient, dead tongues and the history of Auric and the Flaness, but enough was enough. Gord liked action better, and he needed excitement. Like the time he had tossed a light stone into the window of the professor of mathematics, and its light had revealed the dawn in a compromising position with the flighty son of a city official. Ward's fellows had been ringed round to see and had cheered. Ward wanted adventure, not lectures, scrolls, and tomes. He thought it was high time he put his lessons in the art of swordsmanship and dagger work to the test, too. How much better than this sheltered life? Break. Well, I mean, here we have, you know, a little description of the kind of education you can get at the Great College with, you know, politics, philosophy, natural and supernatural arts. Now, natural and supernatural arts, I would just think that is the study of the more than mundane, rather than an actual learning of magical abilities, but maybe the study of how magical creatures, demi-human creatures, and the more than human, you know, maybe even a little study about the undead and the, you know, the various things that exist in Greyhawk that are only like, you know, fanciful in our world. They're real in Greyhawk, and so they're a matter of study. But I don't think any of that is a study of clerical or magic using abilities. I like the pantheology, which is, you know, the study of the various pantheons, and the business of learning about Auric and the Flaness. So obviously, you can study how far that goes. Does that just simply mean the Olmen and the Baclunish, as well as, you know, the basic Flan, the area of the Flaness, or does it even go further than that? And as today, we can see that there's interest in expanding the borders of what's known about all of Earth, was Gygax thinking that it was among the educated well enough known about areas beyond just like what's on the Darlene map? And, you know, is that it? Was that as far as they knew? Or is there a knowledge of what's beyond it? I mean, you know, it's very interesting, but undetailed.
Yeah, you would assume that there is a little bit more, or it would be a study of the whole planet. Planet's just the continent or continents, but you can't really say what was there, I don't think, unless we have more information.
Yeah, and it would seem that with powerful divination and powerful magic users who can travel planes and communicate with other planar beings, demons and devils and such, and it would seem that they at least should have some knowledge of what exists, you know, further than the edge of the Baclunish and further south than the Olmen and across the ocean, that there should be knowledge by some of what is going on. All right. I am on the last section of here of the chapter, so I'm going to read this and finish up this chapter nicely here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 75. It is the second to last paragraph, the first after this little break between one section and another. All right. Four craftsmen from a nearby village entered the rock and Oliphant and took a table nearby. Gord recognized them. They were staying at the Acorns while they attended a meeting of their chapter of the Artisans League. After ordering bumpers of the local brew, four fell into conversation about their trade. Gord could not shut out this droning and endless shop talk, even by downing all of his wine and ordering more. When more of their fellows joined them, Gord abruptly decided that, as of this minute, he had had enough of this kind of life. He got up, stalked away to his chambers, and began gathering up his necessary possessions. An hour later, he bade the good ostler Calvert adieu, and exited the inn forever. Soon he was beyond the pale of Clerkburg, and striding up the processional. Since he had money to spend, and wished some real action, he was going to the high quarter to see what he could see. It was time to start at the top. Break. That is end of the chapter. You know, it's a good conclusion. We're introduced to the Artisans League. The beginning of this chapter starts with the rock and elephant and ends. Here we have finally, Gord finished with his studies. And now starting to entering another phase of his life, going to the high quarter. And, even though he still doesn't seem to know much, like in general, that during this time it doesn't seem as if he's really gone beyond, many expeditions to the high quarter or the garden quarter. It seems like this really is a leap into the unknown right here for Gord and a much different life, but he seems a very skilled individual. We have an interesting tidbit with the Artisans League that the craftsmen, even outside of the city, are part of this organization that encompasses more than just the city. But what they ended up, I guess, calling the Domain of Greyhawk, but at least villages nearby. That even at this level, there is the organization, the sense of order that goes from the city, and it is around the city as well, that the villages nearby are also part of the order that is established by the city of Greyhawk.
Yeah, it sounds like he's going to get in trouble to me.
It sounds like he's looking for trouble.
Yeah, true.
You know, I mean, that is probably one of the essences of an adventurer, is that Gygax's mind, that the player is playing somebody who is out there willing to take chances, you know, not only extraordinary in ability, but also extraordinary in temperament, where they're willing to take these chances and, you know, go off into the unknown. And just, you know, really trust their skill and their luck, rather than live a safer but more mundane and boring existence. And, you know, San was the first to go, but even Gord realized he was not going to be an academic. And beyond a certain point of rounding off his character and giving him certain advantages, say when he wants to go... Now, obviously, from one of the descriptions of the students, that they were snobbish and the dons were snobbish, obviously that the normal student is going to be from a much higher social level than the people who are craftsmen and the people who are the average workers and the average resident of the city. They're not going to be the students. These students are going to be drawn from an upper class. Not only because of the expense of the school, which, you know, it's really, it's interesting that really he doesn't mention when Prosper sends him to Gray College, the actual, I would like to have learned what the tuition was at the college, because obviously if they're paying Prosper, then they would have been paying Gray College as well. We're really given a very thin veneer of information about Gray College, and I'm just reminded of several you know, several books, you know, real world books that talk about you know, the British college institutions of not even like the medieval or Renaissance, but more of the coming industrial age, you know, where there is the snobbishness, whereas you know, the but an organized structure, even up to pre-World War I, where there was a lot of writing about how that, you know, it was a changing time, and that those colleges, so many of those young men went off and died in World War I, that it changed the structure of the colleges. So there's quite a number of things about the public schools for the younger students and the college-level schools that's been written, and I kind of think Gygax is either taking that from books or film and using that to flesh out the background without commenting on fleshing it out. Mm-hmm. So
I think even today there's still some kind of attitude with the top tier schools, Cambridge, Oxford, Ivy League, MIT, Stanford, even, you know, schools like that, and the people who are able to attend them, like just by paying for it rather than scholarship or something.
Yeah, and I know from, you know, from what I've seen, you know, I have no direct experience, but what I've seen in literature and television, and it can be drama or humor, about how they portray that elitism and that structure. There's a British comedy show called Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, and it shows, you know, the British government, where their bureaucracy is composed of members of that upper class, where the elected officials are not, and that the members of the bureaucracy, that they are from all these good schools and have classical educations, where they've learned Greek and Latin and the classics, and they have this sense of snobbishness. And the political leaders, even up to the prime minister, is maybe just somebody chosen as a popular political figure, and maybe comes from a very much less respected kind of education. And that only goes as far as me to basically like the 70s or so. But even then, you see that idea. And I would say that the thing that would imply is that the students who are going to these colleges are going to be part of the ruling elite of the city of Greyhawk. And that while you might have people who are powerful guild masters, like Aaron Paul, the head of the Thieves Guild, may not come from that, but we can see that I would suggest that this structure of the political organization of Greyhawk beyond the directors is probably coming from these elite aristocrats within the city.
Right.
And you know, it does imply to me what kind of, it immediately starts getting my imagination working on how the city of Greyhawk is run and structured, you know. So I think in very few words, Gygax is able to, by use of history, by use of popular fiction, I think Gygax is very quickly able to, you know, inspire a depth of background that you just don't normally see. You know, that you don't have to go into so much detail because you can just look at other detailed sources and get the idea this is what he's talking about. And it doesn't have to be deeply complex. It could be as much as like, well, look at this TV show, look at this movie, and get the idea that this is what the is going to be in the Greyhawk, but in a fantasy way.
Right. He taps in. He has a knack for tapping into common themes and evoking your imagination with that.
Yes. And I mean, that is something that, you know, like people complain about Lovecraft and his purple prose and such. And yet these people complain, but don't have the ability to tap into the sense of drawing upon the horrific imagination we hold inside of us, which details things in so much better and perfectly, because it's our own imagination. You're never going to have anything as scary as what you draw from your own imagination, and it is never going to be a static thing. It's always going to be the most scary thing. So that if you know, gore and you know, when there's too much blood and guts in a movie, after a while we become, you know, we become used to it and withdrawn from it with shock value. If you use the imagination, that never ends. You know, if something scares you in a Lovecraft book, it can scare you forever because it's going to shift and morph into whatever scares you the most at the time of you reading it. That if you read it at 12, you're scared then. If you read it at 50, it's going to scare you at what scares you at 50. And Gygax is able to look at what he's setting up for Greyhawk and with very few words come up with a depth that is drawn from your imagination rather than specifics that, you know, either grow, you know, you're not going to perhaps agree with as much as what you're going to imagine. Well, we are now past 7, and unfortunately I got to go tonight. I'd like to remind everybody that there is going to be a new Twitch show with Anna and Alyssa Fadden tonight on mapping in a short while that I know I don't want to miss. And as for the previous recordings here, the previous recordings are archived on the Cannon Fire website. So if you want to start at the beginning or find sections that you're very interested in and maybe not have to go through, because we already have 8 or 9 hours set aside of these recordings, and it's just going to keep growing, that you can go to the archive and either start at the beginning or pick and choose where you want to, you know, listen within the books. Do you not want to hear about the Beggars Thieves, or do you want to hear about them and not something else? We're going to eventually have a much greater definition of where the recordings are simply by saying they cover from, say, page 50 to 60, you know, 61 to 71. And so down the road, when we've got probably 40 or 50 hours of recordings for this book to complete it, you're not going to have to listen to 40 or 50 hours straight through unless you want to, and you're going to be able to go and find the areas that maybe interest you a little more, and just follow them. And because the commentary is the thing here, it is really not as important to listen to this sequentially as it is to pick and choose what you want to hear about and what you're interested in. Again, you know, it'd be very nice if you can get a copy of the books, follow along. And for this book and anything relating to the City of Greyhawk, get yourself a copy of the map from City of Hawks. And that will give you a good eye view of the territory that we're talking about. And several of the books have information about the city, really worth having that map. The book itself, you know, if you can get a copy of City of Hawks, that's a very good book on, you know, more setting information, more City of Greyhawk information. All right, that is it for today.